Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Gray Matter. Well, today we are very, very grateful to have with us someone who is an esteemed Canadian, a decorated Canadian. He's the Honorable Preston Manning. He's a decorated Canadian, member of the Privy Council. Really, his both he and his family are historic Albertans and Canadians. I can tell you that during the time when he was busy starting the Reform Party back in the late 80s and early 90s, I was a student at the University of Alberta, watching very, very closely the development, the incredible growth of that party to the point where it became, it actually formed the official opposition in Canada. And I can't remember a time in my lifetime when there was more optimism in Western Canada as an Albertan. And so we're very happy to have Mr. Manning on the program today. And I should say, first of all, to him, welcome to the Octogenarian Club. I note that June 10th was an auspicious date in your life. And we're so happy that you're here. And I'll say for our viewers, they're going to find out very shortly when we start talking with him that although he and Mr. Biden are roughly the same age, they're very distinct in terms of mental acuity. As we always do, we start off the program framing it in a few in terms of a few quotations, and these are somewhat in honor of our special guest today. The first one I have is from someone who's often quoted on this program, the author C.S. Lewis, and this is from a book that he wrote called A Grief Observed. Quotation reads as follows: "You never know how much you really believe anything until its truth or falsehood becomes a matter of life and death to you. It's easy to say you believe a rope to be strong and sound as long as you are merely using it to cord a box. But suppose you had to hang by that rope over a precipice. Wouldn't you then first discover how much you really trusted it? Only a real risk tests the reality of a belief." The next one is from Albert Schweitzer, and he was famously quoted as saying this: "The purpose of human life is to serve and to show compassion and the will to help others." And that certainly applies to Mr. Manning. The next one is from Benjamin Franklin, one of the great minds who framed the American Constitution. And he famously wrote, "They that can give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety." And of course, that's very prescient in terms of what's going on in Canada today. The next one is from a British philosopher whom I quote often on this program, the late Roger Scruton, who, and on the subject of populism, which is very well known to Mr. Manning, Dr. Scruton wrote that being unpopular is never easy, but being unpopular in a good cause is a shield against despair. And finally, one that I think will speak to our guest, because he's written about it often, is a quote from Aristotle, who once famously wrote, "The purpose of knowledge is action, not knowledge." Okay, so who do we have on the show today? Well, we have the Honorable Preston Manning. And as I said to him before we went on, we could have a whole show. We could have a week-long mini-series on this man's biography. But what I'm going to do is give a brief introduction. And then we're going to get into some very interesting topics. Because Mr. Manning, although he's retired formally from politics, he's not really retired in any active sense. He's very, very busy working on behalf of Canadians still. And we want to talk about some of the things he's doing right now. But here he is, Preston, and this is from a biography I found of him online. It says, "Preston tirelessly championed the cause of democratic and political reform throughout his impressive career as one of Canada's great political visionaries." In fact, I should, just as an aside, my friend Peter Hawley describes Mr. Manning as the best prime minister we never had. His presentations provide an inspirational and substantive discussion of both current issues and future challenges, all imbued with a surprising dose of humor that you might not expect from a politician. A reformer at heart, Mr. Manning is right at home, challenging the status quo and conventional thinking. Serving as a member of the Canadian Parliament from 1993 to 2001, Preston founded two political parties, the Reform Party of Canada and the Canadian Reform Conservative Alliance. Both of these became the official opposition in the Canadian Parliament and led to the creation of the Conservative Party of Canada, which formed the federal government of Canada from 2004 to 2015. Preston served as leader of the opposition from 1997 to 2000, is a companion of the Order of Canada, a member of the Queen's Privy Council for Canada, a member of the Alberta Order of Excellence, and has received honorary degrees from six Canadian universities. He's also founder of the Manning Center for Building Democracy, a national not-for-profit organization that supports research, training, and communications initiatives. Prior to entering politics, Preston owned and operated a management consulting firm which specialized in long-range planning and communications for the energy sector. He has published two books, actually more than two, but the two that are mentioned here, The New Canada and Think Big, we're going to get to the other ones later. He's also served as a senior fellow of the Canada West Foundation, the Fraser Institute, the Marketplace Institute of Regent College for UBC, as a distinguished visitor at the University of Calgary and University of Toronto. I should also mention, and I'm grateful to them for introducing me to Mr. Manning. He's also part of the Frontier Center for Public Policy, of which I'm very proud to be a senior fellow. So, Preston, Mr. Manning, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. That was rather a glowing introduction. I'm not sure I can live up to this, but I shall try. I shall try.
Well, I'm certain. I'm not going to start off disagreeing with you, but I'm certain that you can live up to it, and that you probably will. Of course, as an Albertan, I'm aware of your exploits and your work, and also the history of your family, which has been so foundational to the development of Alberta and indeed of Western Canada. In terms of your father and his relationship to Mr. Eberhardt. I want to get into the topic, some of the things that are happening right now in Canada, and get your thoughts, because I know I heard you speak recently at an event, and I was very pleased and excited to hear what you have to say, that there is a path out of the mess that we seem to be in Canada today. And talking about this, just today, you might have heard this, Preston, but the Justice of the Peace in Ottawa has just denied the release of Tamara Leach. And I'm reading here, it says that this Justice of the Peace said that Leach was flaunting her award that she received for freedom, for her role in an illegal occupation and her role in illegal activity, speaking, of course, of the truckers' convoy. And so I guess where I want to start off with is, how did we get here? What are the cultural and political forces that seem to be subverting the rule of law and our institutions in Canada? Do you have some ideas about how we got here? It seems like it happened overnight. Just in 2015, we had a well-respected prime minister in office who delivered us a responsible budget, and generally things in Canada looked like peace, order, and good government. And here we are 7 years later, and the country's never been more divided. We've never been in less esteem internationally. And, everybody is just feeling like, the sky is falling. What happened?
Well, I think there's a lot of roots to where we are now. I do think the COVID pandemic and the government, the federal government's response to it, is sort of a trigger and gave an opportunity for the Trudeau administration to advance far more rapidly and more vigorously a number of the political ideas to which it subscribes. This treatment of Tamara Leach is, I think, utterly unconscionable. This is persecution, not prosecution of the law. And I don't understand why more people don't rise up in protest to this. Normally, these bail hearings, even for serious criminals, last an hour, 2 hours. I don't know how many she's had, but they last all day. And the prosecution and the government uses this as an attempt to present its side of the story over and over again, which is swallowed by the standard media. This Carlton Remand Center, where she's being kept, is, been described by people that are in there as a hellhole. And they send these homicide detectives to take, this is a 5 foot tall woman, matey heritage, treat her like an absolute criminal. And I think that's just indication of the over the top reaction on the part of the government and using the COVID crisis in particular to advance those kinds of principles, that kind of activity. And one of the things I've been involved in, I know you wanted to talk about this, I think ultimately the country's going to demand a full-blown official inquiry into how this thing was managed, to hold accountable the people that mismanage it, but probably more important to figure out what can we do to make sure this sort of thing doesn't happen again. And I think that inquiry is going to get into everything. The points you made there, it's going to get into how did the rights and freedoms guaranteed in the Constitution just be cavalierly overridden, not just by the Prime Minister and the Cabinet, but by junior bureaucrats. How did these rights and freedoms that are supposedly constitutionally guaranteed just get washed under the bus under this case? How are the health impacts of this? I mean, Canadians have been told for years that our healthcare system is the best in the world. Well, they're finding out that that's not true. It may be the most expensive in the world, but it's not the best. It had no surge capacity. It had no, but where's the reaction to that? Where's the healthcare reform that ought to have come out of this even 2 years ago? I think this inquiry will get into the economic impacts. Did the government do any economic impact assessment before it imposed an economic lockdown? This has cost people thousands of jobs, millions of dollars in income and bankruptcies. So I think there's going to be this increasing demand for an independent, full investigation into this to see what went wrong and what can be done in the future to make sure it never happens again.
I want to get into deeper into sort of the guts of that and the work that you're doing. And in particular, we want to talk about the report that you wrote, this sort of thought experiment that you've developed. But before we go there, I wanted to sort of bounce this off you, if I could. I don't think I'm letting the cat out of the bag by saying that you're a person of Christian faith. You've written a book about Moses and leadership. I had another guest on this program, a man you probably know well, Mr. Brian Peckford. And when he and I had our discussion, we talked about the importance of having God at the head of the state, and how sort of at the 5,000 foot level, how the secularization of Canada has really taken much away from sort of the moral, ethical foundation of our country. So that when you look at, for example, in the context of the Charter, all these rights exist. And of course, in the preamble, it talks about the supremacy of God and the rule of law. But then when you look at the way that the Charter is being interpreted, it really doesn't seem to have any regard for those things. And so that there seems to be something very, very essential that's missing in the discussion. And that secularization, I think, is and Mr. Peckford agrees, is very damaging to our culture. I know that's a very broad sweeping question, but do you see what I'm getting at? I want to get your take on this, given your background and your own personal faith. What are your thoughts in that regard?
Well, I think what you say is true. Even that reference to whereas Canada is founded upon principles that acknowledge the supremacy of God. One of the courts in ruling on that said that that was a dead letter and could only be resurrected. She used that word, only resurrected by a decision of the Supreme Court, which is a slap in the face to any Christian believer. If you said something like that with respect to Islam or to Buddhism or something like that judge would no longer be a judge. But you can take a swipe like that at the Christian faith or the Judeo-Christian faith without any punishment. Well, no, I think this whole secularization has, of course, been a huge trend. And but I get onto what can you do about it? And I do, and other people have pointed this out, that Christianity has never been stronger when it's persecuted.
Right.
When it's been a minority. Like one of your quotes, that separates out what you really believe in.
Yes.
You didn't say you believe in this or that until when there's no price for holding that belief. But when there is a price, then that sorts the sheep from the goats. And so I think part of the challenge to secularism it is for Christians to become more involved in my case, in the political system, and to take the advice that Jesus gave to his own gang when he sent him out to do public work for the first time. You call in the New Testament, the historians say that for the first year, he did all the talking and all the teaching and all the rest of it, and his people, his disciples, followed along, just watched what he did, what he said. But about a year in, he said, I'm going to send you out now to do something. But he gave him this guideline. He said, be wise as serpents and gracious as doves. And that's a powerful analogy in the Judeo-Christian tradition. I mean, the serpent in the Old Testament scriptures was a symbol of the devil. So he said, be smart as the devil. And the dove was the symbol of the Spirit of God. So he said, be as gracious as the Spirit of God. And I always add, he did not say, be vicious as snakes and stupid as pigeons. And that's, if Christians want to make an impact in a secular society, I think there's lots that has to be done, but it has to be done wisely and has to be done graciously.
Do you think that we were a better nation when we sort of had this commonly held sense of Judeo-Christian morality? Is that something that we should be trying to restore in Canada? Or do we have to get to a new place, a new form of secular society, that let's say is more respectful of the Christian faith?
Well, I think one has to be careful about sort of judging the moral or ethical tone of any, either in the past, this business of evaluating things in the past by our standards today, whatever those standards are, I think leads to more misrepresentation than it does to understanding. I think more realistic challenge for believers today, and I would include Christians, but this is true of people of other faiths whose spirituality is knocked on the head by secularity, is that the challenge for us is to relate our faith to what is going on. And in the political arena, this is difficult. You'll be hammered for even raising the subject, in secular people say that doesn't belong here, but I think one has to insist, yes, it does belong here, and here's a way to present it in a way that's not necessarily offensive to you, but is relevant to the situation. So this business of us learning how to be wise as serpents and gracious and dove in a circumstance like that. And remember, he said that in a circumstance where his little group was a tiny, tiny minority opposed on both the religious front, because he was challenging the Jewish heritage and totally opposed by the Roman authorities. I mean, the circumstance under which he said that was not very friendly to the spiritual, and yet he said it, and this is what you're to do in this situation. I think that's a historical thing we can take and act upon. Yeah, I wrote this book a while back on faith leadership and public life, and I tried to extract the lessons from Moses in the Old Testament and from Jesus himself. And I think there's lots to be learned there on how to behave in as a minority group.
Yeah. I agree. I read the book. I had a particular interest in it because my first 2 years in college, I was at a school called Camrose Lutheran College. You'll remember it in Camrose. It's now part of Augustana, but at that time it was a Lutheran college, private college. And in my second year of religious studies there, I wrote a paper on Moses. And my paper was, in hindsight, was pretty lousy when I compared it to what I learned from reading your book. But anyway,
Leighton, while we're still on this sort of reviving traditions, this sort of relates to it. In my lifetime politically, I've listened to hundreds and hundreds of speeches, most of which deserve.
I can just imagine,
including many of mine. But one speech that I have always remembered, it was made a long time ago in Edmonton by a Latvian scholar. And it was entitled The Three Great Commandments of Western Civilization. This was at a celebration or commemoration of Latvia, of course, was overrun by the Soviet Union for a long, long time and dictated to by communism, which tried to stamp out the religious tradition, cultural tradition of that country. And she was talking about how do you revive this. And but she said, these are the three great commandments of the Western civilization that need to be revived. The first was know thyself from Socrates and the Greeks. The second was control thyself from the Hebrew and Roman lawmakers. And the third one was give yourself by Jesus of Nazareth. Oh, and when you talk about a revival of Western, I don't mean Western in Western Canada, I mean Western world, those three commandments, know yourself, control yourself, and give yourself, is a pretty mm-hmm. good guide to ethical behavior in whatever situation mm-hmm.
you're in. You know? That's a wonderful blend of sort of these two streams that are so at the foundation of Western culture. I read a book by Ben Shapiro a couple of years ago. It's called The Right Side of History. And the thesis of the book is essentially what you just said, that Western culture is at base this this blending of Judeo-Christian morality with, you know, the reason, the tradition of reason that we got from the Greeks all the way through the Enlightenment. And the theme of the book is not all that optimistic. He thinks we're sort of living off the fumes of that right now. Okay. I like to be more. I like you the way you think, because you know, my impression is that you're more optimistic about things, and that's kind of what I want to talk about. So, what we're experiencing right now globally, and we're experiencing it in Canada also, is this this sort of globalization. We had an economist on the program recently. His name is Dr. Paul Frators. And when I asked him, he's in Britain, and I asked him what he thought the antidote would be to this sort of globalization, presuming that it's a bad thing, and I happen to think it is. And he said that the antidote is patriotism, but not the sort of toxic nationalism, or as Mr. Trudeau calls it, over-nationalism, whatever that is. You have to be people kind to understand that, I think. But the positive patriotism, the kind that makes us want to come out and show our flags on Canada Day, the kind that, you know, I think the, you know, the truckers were showing in the Freedom Convoy. Would you agree with that? That is one of the ways that we can perhaps restore some of the positive sense or the optimism in Canada? Like, how do we sort of fight this, you know, the sort of globalism that seems to be destroying and whittling away at our cherished Canadian institutions?
Well, I think one thing, if you have to participate in a global, and there is a sense in which you have to participate in a global economy and global communications system, the first step to being able to participate in it is to be strong nationally. You have to be strong yourself to participate in that. So that professor's word of strengthening your own identity, even understanding your own identity and strengthening it and not being ashamed of it, I think is one of the keys to being able to participate in globalization as a participant, not a simply a mindless victim of global trends. And this, Canada's always wrestled with this identity question, and it's part of our national unity problem. This may be only partially responding to what you're saying, but recently I've been appealing to particularly the Conservative Party. Why doesn't some national federal political party officially recognize the regional character of Canada, that Canada, among other things, is a bunch of very major regions, each of which has distinctive characteristics, distinctive aspirations: Atlantic Canada, Quebec, Ontario, the prairies, the Rockies, the Pacific Coast, the North, however you want to divide it up. And the reason I got into this is, as you know, there's been a number of political people in Western Canada in trying to get some federal party, particularly the Conservative Party, to be more recognizing the regional identity of Western Canada's concerns, its alienation, its aspirations. And the pushback on that from people in the party is, if we recognize your regional aspirations and concerns and alienation, we'll alienate somebody else in other parts of the country. So we can't do that. So our comeback to that was, well, why don't you recognize the regional character of the entire country and say, we're going to recognize these distinctives in each region and try to, as a federal government, try to do something about them. And the price that you get in your regional concerns and addressed is you cooperating on somebody else. And that way, Western alienation or Quebec distinctiveness or whatever doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. It's part of the national identity. To which a federal government should, or which a federal government should recognize. And that was one sort of small way of trying to deal with this identity problem, which in Canada surfaces in different ways, often more regionally than nationally, and a federal government has to come to grips with it. And we thought maybe that's one way to come to grips with that aspect of our national identity.
Mm. No, I think that's a great point. And it reminds me of a poll I recently saw. Maybe you saw the same one. It said for the first time, independence is more supported in Alberta than it is in Quebec. And I think this speaks to this this alienation, which I think has been exacerbated by the COVID-19, because COVID-19, it isolated individuals and communities so much. It feels like, at least in my lifetime, we've never felt so divided in our country. And so coming to this COVID-19 issue, I'm interested to know, before we get into some of the solutions, what do you think is going to be the legacy of this COVID-19 period that we're in, because it's not over? And why is the Trudeau government still so bent on perpetuating these divisive policies? Just recently, you've probably heard the federal health minister is talking about redefining fully vaccinated, or saying that there's no such thing as fully vaccinated. We're going to have to go for these jabs every 9 months. Why are they so hell-bent on continuing these policies? Is it really health, or is there something else?
The consequence of this will await this necessity for having a full-blown investigation in it, because what that could do, if it was well done, is separate out what was done right, what was done, even if it was done wrong, what was done from the right motivation, what was that, and what was just fundamentally done wrong. And then in order to plot a course for the future so that this never happens again, you need that kind of information. So I'm not sort of avoiding what will be the ultimate consequences of this, but I think that very much depends on getting this independent investigation. And politically, this creates a challenge. If you challenge the current federal government to hold a royal commission or something, well, it would be a whitewash commission, because you're asking the government to investigate itself. That means if this investigation were to be held now, it would almost have to be a non-governmental commission. But how do you actually set that up? How do you get enough credibility with the commissioners, whoever they are, that the people would regard it as a genuine inquiry? But there is efforts are being made to do that, and that may come about. The other alternative is when this government is replaced, as it will be sooner or later, that the successor government could then set up a genuine royal commission or a commission under the Inquiries Act, and you could have this investigation. But I know I'm sort of harping on this, but I do think there has to be this investigation of how this thing went, what went right, what went wrong, and what can we learn from the future in order to predict what are the long-range consequences of this COVID pandemic and the way it was responded to in this country.
Okay, so let's harp on it some more, because this is really interesting. So you took some time to develop something that I called, and I hope you didn't take this untoward, because I wrote a commentary on it. I described this as almost like a thought experiment, where you imagined what you're talking about, and you called it the report of the COVID Commission, a fictional futuristic description of this. And it has different parts. So let's talk about these. The first part is, before we go there, you've already told us what its intended purpose is. Mm-hmm. But the first step is the Citizens Coalition. So tell us about the Citizens Coalition and what happened last month in Toronto.
Well, as you say, and I always, in talking about this, I stress to people, this is fiction, but it's it's got a lot of facts in it too.
Yes.
I imagine that this the spirit that was expressed by the Freedom Convoy, a bottom-up protest against aspects of the health protection measures that people considered unnecessary and unfair. In my thought experiment, I imagine that this grows into something bigger and becomes an even bigger. And there was actually signs of that when the Freedom Convoy was held. There was people that joined that were not truckers. But they identified with this endeavoring to protest the inequity of some of the health protection measures. So I imagine in this that this grows and grows and grows to the point where it actually becomes a political movement and merges with the Conservative Party and actually wins the next election, replaces the...
Right.
The, and I drew the parallel between, and this is worth thinking about, these younger people won't remember this, but the Solidarity movement in Poland in the late 1980s. It started with a strike at the shipyard in Gdansk, just like this thing started with a strike by truckers. And one of the spokesperson, Lech Walesa, he was a labor guy speaking for the strikers. But, you know, 10 years later, the guy was president of Poland. But that movement, it started with a strike and a few people, but it became a symbol of an autocratic government trampling down on these ordinary people. And it grew and grew and grew. So in my imaginary thing, I imagine this grows to the point where it actually replaces the government. And then this new government commissions this full-blown royal commission, what I call the COVID commission, to look into the whole thing. But this, as a, this is a sort of a sideline on this. There's about 30 groups that I know of in the country that are upset about this, the whole way COVID was managed, to the point where they want to see an independent inquiry if possible. One of these groups is the Canadian COVID Care Alliance. It's mainly made up more of medical and science people who believe in an alternative narrative than the one that the government produced. But they are in favor of having this independent inquiry. But to give people maybe a taste of what might it look like, what might it do, they put on a three-day citizens hearing, they called it. It was people could participate in person or virtually, and it went on for 3 days, and we had a little panel. I was one of the panelists, and we heard testimony from 60 different people. Most of them were just victims of what had gone wrong as a result of some of them were victims of they were fully vaccinated and something went sideways. Some of them were victims of the lockdown measures. Some were victims from the civil rights standpoint. But it was intended, and I think one can go to their website and take a look at this thing. It was intended to show people this is kind of what it would be like if you had this kind of an inquiry. Wouldn't be a good thing. Now the difference is that when it's an informal inquiry like that, we can't subpoena witnesses. We can't compel anybody to come. We can ask them, will you tell the truth? We can't ask them to swear, will you tell the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. But in a real inquiry, you could do that. And you could, the inquiry could subpoena a lot of these people that were involved in implementing these regulations and developing them and in applying them, et cetera, et cetera. And they would be subject to cross-examination. And often what happens in those types of inquiries, the first people you could get in would be the lower ranks, you know, the poor policeman that was told had to go and do this and give the ticket to the 90-year-old woman for not wearing a mask, and these lower echelon people. And in the cross-examination, what the examiner will say, why did you do what you did? And the standard answer will be, because I was told to. Mm-hmm. I was just carrying out orders. So then it's the next question that's the killer. Who gave you those orders?
Right.
And if a prosecution pursues that long enough, it goes up and up and up the tail. It goes beyond the little guy. It goes beyond the assistant director. It goes beyond the director. It goes beyond the assistant deputy minister. It gets right up to the top, just like mm-hmm. the Watergate investigation started right. down here. Mm-hmm. Got right up to the president's office. So that's kind of the... In this fictional account of the COVID commission, I try to describe how that might happen. And this citizens hearing that the CCCA put on was an attempt to kind of demonstrate this is what it might look like so that people could get an idea of that and maybe be more supportive of it.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me there was a loudmouth lawyer from Alberta who testified there in Toronto last month too. It's funny that it's interesting that you mentioned the situation with Poland. We actually had Artur Pawlowski on this program, and he mentioned that he lived through that actually as a young boy. I guess that's a great example of the power of a populist movement. And of course, you designed one of these yourself, didn't you? Because that's really what the Reform Party, when I heard you speak about the Reform Party and what I've read about it is, initially, you had no designs on creating a political party. The way I recall this is actually, you got together with some people in a hotel room or at a hotel at a meeting. You didn't really didn't know what you had. And then you contacted Mr. Mulroney, who was prime minister at the time. And you said, hey, you know, there's something going on. You should really do something about it, kind of like what you're doing now. Of course, he reacted very, very in a way that I think the Conservative Party regrets. And then within a number of years, a short span of years, here you are, you're leader of the official opposition to Parliament. So I think that's a great example of what can happen, right? If you've envisioned it, you start with the vision, and then, as you like to say, do something, you know, boots on the ground. So in terms of this COVID inquiry, are we still at the stage where we're forming the Citizens Coalition? Is that the stage that we're in?
Well, like what the particularly the Liberal and NDP politicians are desperately hoping, and then they, you know, political people apply this strategy. They hope to change the channel. When a government gets into trouble over issue A, they desperately want to change the channel. They'd rather get an argument over issue B, even if it's one that they don't particularly like, but change the channel. And that is very much the hope of the governing powers, that people, they're tired of this COVID thing. It's almost over, so let's just forget about the whole thing. Now, I think that change the channel strategy will not work. It'll work with the traditional media, but I don't think it will work with the rank and file. There was enough people hurt by what was done, hurt on the health front. It wasn't just people that suffered from COVID. It was people who died on the waiting lines because they couldn't get treatment for other diseases. There were subsidiary health effects of the COVID thing that were horrific, that ruined families. They're not going to forget that because somebody on television says they should worry about something else. The economic impacts, it's going to take years to recover. Mm-hmm. This has affected the work ethic of the younger up to 35 element to the point where employers can't find people to do certain types of work because of attitudes that were developed during COVID. So I don't think the channel will be changed. And so there is room for this bottom-up type of expression. And you go back to the reform story, actually, and this is when you talk about understanding your own political culture, and I've been in debates on this. In Quebec, the soft nationalism is a component of every major third party in Quebec. Soft nationalism, hard nationalism. You cannot understand the Quebec political culture without understanding nationalism, soft nationalism. It's created the whole third party tradition in Quebec, the Bloc Populaire, the Union Nationale, the Ralliement des Crédités, the PQ, the ADQ, the CQ, all of them. And in Western Canada, the equivalent of that is populism is part of the Western tradition. All the Western third parties had a populist dimension to them. The Riel rebellions, if you want to go back that far, the farmers' parties, the progressive party, the depression party, the CCF, the social credit reform. The populism is an integral part of the Western political culture, just as nationalism is the integral part of the Quebec tradition. And what reform, I was aware of that. And when in the 1980s, when there was a lot of this Western unrest, I thought that this is going to produce another political movement. I used to have that discussion with Joe Clark. Joe was committed to the Federal Conservatives when he was a very young guy when we were at university. And Joe believed, he didn't think the Federal Conservative PC Party was perfect, but he thought he wanted to work within it and try to make it an instrument. And I respected him for that. I said, I don't think I'll do that. I think I'll wait till the West produces another one of these things and maybe go along with that. And that's what did did happen. The one you said earlier about looking for, is there anything encouraging? Like, I've been a critic of the democratic system in Canada. I think it can be vastly improved. But having said that, that reform thing started with these five people. We actually met in a boardroom. And we couldn't even agree on everything, but it started very small like that, and then it grew and grew and grew and grew. So, and all, what did we do? We just took the tools that democracy gives to everybody. If it's a free society, the freedom of speech, freedom of movement, ability to try to talk you into voting this way instead of that way, and by golly, it ended up eventually forming a governing party. So, with all the flaws, a Canadian democracy and all the impediments, you could still do that in this country. You could not do that in the United States. We didn't have any money. The only money we could get was this small amounts of money from large numbers of people. So while one can be very pessimistic about the way things have turned out, I do think there is an opportunity to take those tools and use them to change the course of the country. The most worrisome thing about this COVID aftermath and other aspects of the government's behavior, when it starts interfering with those rights, the right freedom of speech, freedom of belief, freedom of mobility. This is a huge country. Like you try and organize it politically, you got to go from Vancouver Island to East Cape and Newfoundland like that. And I've made those trips a long, long way, but you got to have freedom of movement or you can't do it.
Right.
So the prospects of there being a change, particularly initiated from the bottom up, is very much dependent on the preservation of some of those key fundamental rights. And when those are threatened, you're not just threatening some political party or some part of the country or threatening truckers. You're threatening the fundamental pillars of a democratic society.
Yeah, and this is what's getting people in Holland and Poland and Italy out on their tractors right now. Yeah. You know, this threatening of fundamental rights that until the day before yesterday, you know, many of us sadly took for granted. And that might be one of the silver linings on the dark cloud, is hopefully people will be more grateful when we come through the other side of this. And I know that we will. I'm hopeful that people are going to be more grateful for the, you know, to have these freedoms, because what we have in Canada, and a lot of people who don't travel don't understand this, what we have in Canada is the exception. It's not the rule. It's sad that unfortunate, and that may be a backhanded blessing of COVID, is that we lost these things for a while.
Granted. And you can't say, like people say, well, my vote, like what does my vote count and everything? But you never know. Like in the 1993 election, which was a huge turning point election, the governing party went from 155 seats to two. And two parties that had hardly been around the previous election, the Bloc Québécois in Quebec and Reform in the West, ended up third of the seats in the parliament. That's as close to a revolution as you're going to get in Canada. But the Bloc had 54 seats and we had 52. And the Bloc used that business of being the official opposition. They used that to lever the Quebec separation thing, sovereignty association, to the point where there was a referendum held eventually on it that was only won by a hair that the country stay together instead of blow apart. We lost three seats in Edmonton by a total of 321 votes.
Oh, wow.
So if we had won the three votes, we would have had 55 and the Bloc would have had 54. So the official opposition pulpit wouldn't have gone to separatists. It would have gone to Western Federalists. So if the country had blown apart as a result of that referendum, that was my worst night in Ottawa, incidentally, because people have no idea how close that came and the chaos that would have created. But if it had gone the other way, I was going to go back to Edmonton. I was going to say, there are 321 of you guys here that you're responsible for blowing up the country because you didn't go out and vote or didn't go out and vote the right way. Mm-hmm. So I used that with younger people to say that. And I felt that myself. What difference is my vote count? But you never know, and it is a privilege. It's people have died to try to keep that privilege, and you ought to exercise it because it's there, you know.
Well, speaking of voting, the part of the the goal, the objective of the COVID Commission is to produce a report that will be the impetus for an election. But before getting there, this COVID Commission would frame 16 key questions, right, that would have to be answered. And I think most people could guess what these questions are, but what are some of those questions that would need to be answered via the COVID Commission?
Well, I guess a number of them get to motivations. Is why did you do what you did? And I think one of the most fundamental one, and this has been raised by others, why did the federal government decide to assign the management of the COVID response to the health department bureaucracy? Bureaucracies are not good at handling emergencies. They're particularly not good at handling emergencies that involve people, emergency involving materials or oil. They can do that, but not people. Why wasn't that assigned to these emergency measures organizations, even if you had to create one specifically for that case? So that would be a very fundamental question. And again, it's relevant for the future. If this ever happens again, big bureaucracies are not the ones to assign the management of these things to. And because Ottawa did it, I think that's the major reason why all the provinces fell into line doing the same thing. I asked actually somebody in one of the maritime governments, how come you guys did it that way? And they said, well, the federal government did it that way. We assumed that there's going to be any funding or money to help the provinces cope with it. We would be better positioned if we were doing the same thing that the feds were doing. So we never even questioned it. So I think that would be one big question would come up. A second one would be, how come you didn't do impact assessments on the measures that you were proposing? Did anybody do an impact assessment of that? Here's a health protection measure that's going to restrict freedoms. Did anybody do an impact assessment of what is that going to do to rights and freedoms? Now, maybe you might have done the same thing at the end of the day anyway, but at least you would have. The Supreme Court, in what was called the Oaks case, it was called right. the Oaks test, said that our Constitution does provide for the government to limit rights in the event of something, but it's got to be justifiable in a democratic society. And the Oaks test said what's justifiable is you have to demonstrate that the benefits of your limitation outweigh the impacts. They use the word impacts. So you'd ask the federal court, did anybody do an impact assessment on the impact on rights and freedoms of the health protection measures? And then of equal importance, and some people would say greater importance, did you not do an impact assessment on those lockdown measures? Mm-hmm. I mean, locking down an economy is it's like saying we're going to lock your heart down for 8 months while we fix something else. Well, you might not be around in the 8 months. And so I think that would be a big question. Why was that not done? Didn't that make sense? So those are the kind of questions that I think that COVID commission would get into. And in that peace of mind, I had about 15 of them. So
yes. And as I said, these are all the questions that I think people would want to know, everything from vaccines and vaccine mandates and things like that. You make a great point about experts, though, and actually about this whole concept of emergency powers. When I questioned Dr. Dina Hinshaw, I cross-examined her in a case in Alberta called Ingram. I had myself and another lawyer named Jeff Rath, who you might know. We had her for about 4 days and questioned her. I asked her about this, and I asked her whether she had an economist on her staff who to give her advice about the economic impacts. And her answer was flatly no. She didn't have that.
What this gets into, Leighton, is exactly this is the way bureaucracies are. Like when you ask the health department people, how come you didn't do the check on the rights and freedoms? That's not our department. You want to know about that? Go to the Justice Department. And right. if you ask the health officials, did you do the impact assessment on the economy? That's not our department. Go and ask the Economic Development Department or the Industry Department. The bureaucracy, and I'm not making a blanket condemnation of bureaucracy, and I'm not making a blanket condemnation of civil servants, but bureaucracy divides things up into these silos, and I'm responsible for this narrow end. If there's other consequences, somebody else is responsible for that. And it's one of the reasons for not for not assigning particularly emergency measures things or things that are comprehensive across the whole society, assigning them to one bureaucracy that can only bring one perspective to bear on it. You know?
Yeah, and it does also lead to this sort of Nuremberg defense too, doesn't it? That I was just following the orders. Yeah. And the other interesting thing about what you just said is something that I think needs to be questioned. I think is in an overarching way is the subject of these 16 questions is, you know, is it wise to have a government to allow government to have access to these emergency powers? Like, do they really need them? One of the things that happened in Alberta in the case I was describing is in the early part of 2020, when the pandemic hit, Mr. Kenney's government went and they rejigged the Public Health Act. And what they did is they gave Dr. Hinshaw enormous powers. They made her the most powerful person in the history of Alberta. Even Bible Bill Eberhardt was not as powerful as Deena Hinshaw was. I mean, everything she said, and the orders read, I, Deena Hinshaw, hereby, you know, declare. And that was and it wasn't just health, as you say, every single aspect of private and public life was impacted by these orders. And yet here we have a bureaucrat, admittedly a doctor, but somebody who had no knowledge of no specific knowledge of things like education, of social welfare programs, of, you know, recreation, or all these other things that were impacted, churches. And so really somebody who's woefully unqualified to have this power, and it's totally non-democratic. And what concerns me about these emergency powers is it uses the legislative democratic machinery to actually set up a dictator. And so part of the question is, and I want to get your thoughts on this, you know, should we even have these emergency powers? I mean, we've seen what governments do with them.
Well, there's a couple of things you can do, and this is what I think would come out of this commission. A couple of things you can do to address the problem that you raise. One is, like, the power to limit these rights is in the Constitution, and the Emergency King actually came out of the War Measures Act. And most people would argue when the war happened, you had to do something drastic, and it was a justification. And then the current Emergencies Act is a sort of a muted down version of the War Measures Act, because Pierre Elliott Trudeau used it in a pretty national way to deal with something in Quebec that it shouldn't. And so it was divided up. It's more moderate than the old War Measures Act, but it still gives all these powers. One way to correct the abuse is to insist that if the government wants to limit rights, whether under an emergency or just under the Constitution, it should do so by a bill introduced to the Parliament. And right. The Parliament has to vote on it, debate it, vote on it, and if necessary, even refer it to the Supreme Court, directly to the Supreme Court, not to lower courts, to tighten up the use of it. And the use of it has to be democratically sanctioned. But the second thing, and I used to do this when I was in the Parliament, this is something that politicians have to watch, and particularly conservative ones. Almost every bill that creates a new something or other has a section in it, and the minister and council will be empowered to make regulations. There's a section, every departmental bill, every agency bill, empowering the minister and cabinet to make make regulations. Now, there's thousands of regulations have been done under these sections. The minister and the cabinet can't even read them, let alone administer them. So it's done by lower levels, by unelected bureaucrats. But the power to make regulations rests there. And I think the Parliament and the legislature has got to be a lot more careful in this granting this regulatory power to lower levels, because half of what's done is done under regulation by people who are no more accountable to the public than the man in the moon. So those are two practical things you could do to maybe prevent these abuses. And if you had this commission, like somebody were like me would make this argument, and then the other side would come back with their lawyers and try to tear it apart. But the commissioners would hear, okay, there's that, here's that, here's what I think we think should be done. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what has the whole bunch of these issues have to be adjudicated on that basis and come up with some recommendations so that these abuses don't occur in the future.
What you say is very interesting, and it's actually something that I talked about with Brian Peckford when he was here. And I wonder if you would agree with this. He has a real concern. It kind of ties in with what you said about how the Canadian political system has really been sort of inverted. We're supposed to have a representative democracy, but what seems to have happened over time, and he thinks it started in the Pierre Trudeau days, is we've had sort of this concentration, almost this vacuuming of power into the federal government. Now it's concentrated in the prime minister's office. And this is really preventing the proper functioning of our democracy. And I want to tie that together with something that I heard you say when you did an interview with Jordan Peterson in his podcast recently. And you were talking about your grandkids and how they're really good hockey players, and always at the rinks there's the scouts looking for the good hockey players. Yeah. But there's nobody around looking for the bright young political minds. And you said something that really struck me, and you said, you know, the way to sort of maybe just to tie this together with what Mr. Peckford said, his lament, is you said that, you know, where people don't get involved at the grassroots level in politics, you know, the elites, you know, those people, when you're not looking, these people enter in, the ones who are power hungry. And so tying those two things together, and tying this together with the COVID commission, is that the solution? That is, people have to get out and really get more involved at the grassroots level with their schools, with their churches, with youth groups, with whatever it is, get involved in what's going on in their communities and not just leave everything up to, you know, government.
And be more careful about the people that you do assign these powers to. I just think I haven't done it yet, but I'm thinking of doing an op-ed on what the political parties can learn from the NHL draft. Like, you know, you have to just go on. But in a way, that NHL draft is the pinnacle of a scouting system.
Yeah.
And that's the point I made with Jordan. Like I say, we have these grandsons. Some of them are playing at a pretty high level now, but we used to go to the rink at, you know, when they're 12 years old and 6 o'clock in the morning, and there's this grizzled old guy sitting in the back row of these empty arenas with a clipboard. Who is this guy? This guy is a scout. And some mm-hmm. of those are scouts for NHL teams scouting 12-year-olds. Jerome McGinn, we used to live up in, say, now Jerome McGinn played when he was 12 in this little league that our guys were in. And by golly, there were people that had spotted him at that age. And my question is, where's the political equivalent of that? Who is out, not 6 months before the election, 10 years before the election, mm-hmm. trying to identify this person, if they were given this kind of training and this kind of opportunity, might be able to play the national political game at the national level. Where is that? Mm-hmm. And it's not there. And we are not getting our best and brightest people of character or competence or commitment. I'm not trying to disparage the people that are there now, but we are not, you know. And that is part of the answer. You've got this opportunity to elect people, but we've got to invest. What do these NHL teams invest in that scouting system, you mm-hmm. know, compared to what political parties invest in recruitment of candidates? It's night and day. So that mm-hmm. that's one way of trying to make this democracy system work better. We've been on the bureaucrats, and I don't want to disparage the bureaucrats, but you might find this amusing. Do you remember, you quoted C.S. Lewis earlier?
Yes.
One of the other books he wrote was The Screwtape Letters.
Oh, yes, yes, brilliant, yes.
Screwtape is his chief devil who's writing to his nephew, who's a junior devil, on how to be a better devil, how to screw up the world better than how to make evil more effective. Well, I've done some letters called the Red Tape Letters. Red tape is the leader of the Bureaucratic Party of Canada, which I argue is now the biggest party in the Canada. There's 471 federal bureaucrats. There's only 338 guys in Parliament and 39 cabinet ministers. So who's running the country, you see? And these red tape is writing to his fellow bureaucrats on how to maximize the strength and the power of the Bureaucratic Party. So I've got to get that out one of these days. And I think it might make the point that you better be careful about the strength of the Bureaucratic Party.
Yeah, well, as I remember the Screwtape letter, Screwtape was pretty inept, but I think he had an essential goodness that it was the reason for it. So hopefully that's true of your bureaucrats as well.
Well, let's see.
So I want to talk to you about this. The last thing I want to come to here is, okay, let's say we get through, we actually get this COVID commission to happen. We get the report, we get the recommendations, and there's an election and there's a change. Let's say it's Mr. Poilievre, who's the new prime minister. And I don't know whether you support him, what you think of him. What is the future of Canada look like? What is the future of the Canadian polity look like over the next 10 years? And I'm asking you sort of forecast based on your long experience seeing different waves, different movements. What do you think Canada is going to look like, that landscape is going to look like over the next 10 to 15 years?
Well, you told me late in advance that you were going to ask that. So I actually tried to sketch down a few things that I think should characterize the post-Trudeau era, whether they will or not depends on a lot. And these things key off where we are now. You can't have some idea that's just completely unrelated to, you know, public policy and laws evolved from what was there before. But so my little list at the top of them is that I think there would be an effort, there'd have to be an effort to get stronger safeguards for the rights and freedoms. This COVID thing has exposed the weakness of the current guarantees. So stronger guarantees for rights and freedoms. As I say, one way would be to just insist that these things can only be limited by an act of parliament that has been debated and referred to the courts and everything else. And another way to put it more personally, that there you set up safeguards so there can be no repeat of the Tamara persecution, that simply cannot happen again. It's a blot on the society. So that's one thing. A second thing, knowing where people's head is at, is I think there has to be a twofold attack on inflation. The polls say this is now becoming one of the number one worries, understandably, of people. And inflation, as I understand, has got two components to it. And I think it's important to know there's two components because there are different solutions to each part. One is the monetary part. If governments overspend and overborrow and print money, you're going to have inflation as a result of that. And that can be fixed a little bit, at least by fiscal policy, you know, going towards balancing budgets, constraining the expansion of the money supply. You can answer that way. But the other part of inflation is when you've got demand and you've restricted supply. You know, if you there's a big demand for something and you restrict the supply of it, what will happen is the price of whatever is there will go up. And this is, of course, what's happened in the energy field. You've got, notwithstanding whatever people say, globally, the demand for oil is still going up over 100 million barrels a day. But if you restrict the supply, then what's going to happen? You're going to drive the price up. So I think a second thing, any new administration, and they'd probably get elected in part on, we've got to come to grips with the inflation problem better than the previous people, would have to address those two aspects of inflation. And then a third one, and this is again rooted in, prompted by the COVID thing, is healthcare reform. This COVID thing has demonstrated the inadequacy of the Canadian healthcare system. And I think what we're moving towards, or should be, is a mixed system, public and private, with universal access. Nobody's talking about taking away universal access and more timely access. And there are a dozen countries now, particularly in Scandinavia and Europe, that have got these mixed systems, and they actually responded better to the COVID than they responded to the surge demand, because they had two ways of responding to the surge demand than Canada just had one. So there's actually a court case, I think you're familiar with it, in BC, there's a court case challenging the restrictions in the BC Medicare Act that restrict developing a mixed system. And the hope is that the courts will say, you can't do that. And this will open the door to some province going through it to develop an alternative system, hopefully a better system, just like Saskatchewan did 60 years ago. They pioneered the current system. Somebody else is going to have to pioneer the new system. And I think that would be an important characteristic of the post. You'll never get the Trudeau Liberals to do it, but you might get other people to do it. And then the fourth and fifth things I had, one was I've already referred to, this dealing with these regional discontents. I think the one way to deal with that is to recognize the regional character of Canada and say a federal government is prepared to recognize the distinctiveness. In the West case, the West, and I stopped talking about Western alienation because it's negative. I put in Western aspirations. What are the distinctive aspirations? Well, the West wants unobstructed transportation corridors to the Atlantic and the Pacific and the Arctic so you can get the resources out. The West wants domestic free trade. We've got free trade north-south, but we don't have it here. You know, we want the equalization reform. We want, there's a list of things, and these are the West demand. Each region can have those, and a federal government says, look, we're going to start addressing these, and the only price of you getting yours dealt with is that you understand we've got to deal with somebody else. And then the last thing on my little list would be the need to strike a balance between this resource development issue and the environment. This is a huge thing. And in this political culture that we live in, and particularly in the United States, this gets polarized. You're either for sort of untrammeled resource development or you're for absolute environmental protection to shut everything down. And, you know, the old joke used to be, why did the Canadian cross the road to get to the middle? We're supposed to have a kind of intuitive ability to find and we're not talking about a meaningless compromise between those. Is there a principled balance between the two? And I think a future federal government that makes the seeking that balance part of its program, maybe has a process. Here's the process to get to the balance. We don't know quite what it is, but here's the process. And part of that process involves doing environmental impact assessments on resource development, but do an economic impact assessment. Some environmental protection measures. So that'd be kind of my short list: the strengthen the rights and freedoms, the reform the healthcare system, deal with the inflation thing and its two dimensions, regional recognition of regional aspirations, and this latter, the balance between environment, natural resources, and that would keep a new government going for both.
Yes, that sounds like a great recipe. I want to follow up with you on just one of those, if you wouldn't mind, and that is this issue of, to use your words, Western aspiration. We had Danielle Smith on this program recently. Of course, she's one of the front runners to succeed Mr. Kenney as our premier in Alberta. But all three of the front runners are talking about something called the Sovereignty Act. Are you familiar with this?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. And, you know, as a lawyer, as a constitutional lawyer, I'm troubled by it because it's almost like asking for, it's an invitation to a constitutional crisis, because fundamentally the idea that Alberta would pass a statute where they would declare that they're not going to follow laws that are passed by the federal government, even when they're under Section 91 constitutional powers, seems to me a recipe for disaster. But what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think there's a way of strengthening that position of sovereignty. You'd have to be very careful in a way that where you didn't create a constitutional crisis. So it very much depends on the fine tuning of that kind of, and I don't know as that kind of fine tuning is occurred. It's kind of at that level. But the second part, I was on the Fair Deal panel that
Right.
set up, which addressed a number of these issues, at least had hearings and heard a lot of sentiment on it. And there's a need to address those types of issues. Now, I'm no question about it. In fact, I named a bunch of them myself. But I think the advancing Alberta's position has got to have a positive dimension to it as well as this defensive element. And I think that's a little bit missing in some of this talk about autonomy. How to defend ourselves against from Ottawa, and there's room for that. And a lot of Albertans can support that regardless of what their party is. But what's the bigger picture? What's the positive alternatives? What's Alberta going to do in the positive sense, you know, and you can think of positive things. Why don't we branch and turn out the Alberta Treasury branch into a national bank and an international bank like the Caisse de dépôt in Quebec? You know, why don't we work out this balance between environment and natural resources? Whatever jurisdiction really figures out how to do that as a message, not just for Canada, but for the world. What's the positive side to the putting the wagons in a circle? And who knows, in this leadership contest for the UCP leadership, that may come out. But right now, the more each trying to demonstrate how they would circle the wagons better than the other guy. So there's more to be added to that, you know.
Right.
I was in the Parliament when, of course, the Quebec secession was the bigger issue. And the harder guy to debate on that, I did debate him, but there were some separatists in Quebec that just took that we can separate and everything's going to be fine. There will be no problem. The economy's going to be fine. And you could argue against that and say it ain't going to be fine. And you could argue. Bouchard was harder to argue with because you could recite, you know, if you guys separate, this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to happen. It's going to be bad. And Bouchard would shake his head and get very sober and says, that's true. But independence is worth it. It's going to cost, but it's worth it. And that guy is harder to argue with, that because what he's saying is actually true than the person that says no. And one of the signs that you're really realistic about secession and Lucien Bouchard was when you do count the cost, when you say this is not just all sweetness and light, there's a cost. Now here's the cost. If you think that cost is worth it, that's a decision you got to make. But a lot of this decision, this discussion of secession in the West, you never hear much talk about the cost.
No.
And sooner or later, that might be part of the discussion. Yeah.
Yeah. And you do have to remind people sometimes.
I know Daniela. I know a number of the candidates. This Travis Taves of the in the Kenny cabinet is a impressive guy, and I appreciate any of these people that in this environment are willing to stick their neck out and say they're willing to participate. But I do think these positions got to be debated and thought through, including the cost.
Yes, and it's, as I said, I was going to say, it's worth reminding some people that utopia literally means nowhere.
Political term. We'll leave.
Yeah. So the last, we kept you for quite a while here. I'm so grateful for your time. We all are. But the last thing I want to ask you, and I know this is right in your wheelhouse, but I want to ask you this question. I know it's one that you've written about a lot. But for the people watching this, taking it in, what advice would you give to, you know, everyday Canadians who seek to restore and preserve, you know, the best of Canadian culture, of Western culture, for posterity, for their children and grandchildren? Well, what things can they do?
Well, a couple of things off the top. One is whatever issue it is that you're concerned about is even getting you thinking about what could I do, to try to understand that issue from more than one perspective. Today, this polarization culture, as no matter what issue it is, there's somebody that's very much telling one side of the story. It may be the side of the story you agree with, and somebody else telling almost the opposite story the other way. And I think one today almost has to make a specific effort to try to understand the issue from at least two perspectives. And just don't assume that, you know, all the views that you now hold are being reinforced by a whole bunch of stuff. Of course, today there's logarithms that can figure out if you like this kind of article, you're going to get 15 more that tell you the same thing. So that may sound very elementary, but I do think this trying to improve our understanding of these issues from more than one perspective, so we don't get sucked in one way or the other. And then the second is to participate in this democratic process. You do have these rights, to have some say in who represents you in the municipal council, who in the provincial legislature, and in the federal parliament. And for some people, this means think, if you don't like what you've got there, or you don't think they're competent enough, give some thought about who else would be there. Have you ever spoken to anybody about maybe running for office? Have you ever said to them, you know, if you were willing to do that, I'd be willing to encourage you and maybe even help you, exercising some of these practical democratic rights right up to the point of voting. I hearken back to that reform experience. You had all kinds of people say, well, you can't do anything, you can't do anything. Well, that ended up creating a majority government, the Harper government. Whether you agree with Stephen or not is not the point. A small group of people managed to kind of do that. And so if you take the tools that our democracy gives to everybody and exercise them, you can have that effect and be particularly concerned when those types of rights are being taken away, because then you can be in real trouble.
I have to say that Stephen Harper government seems like halcyon days right now. This brings us, sir, to the part of this podcast that people tell me they like a lot. It's called the reading list. And the hard part about the reading list today was to narrow it down, because you've written a number of books. I've chosen three that I've actually read. I haven't read all of them yet. But one of them is the report of the COVID Commission, which has been published. It was written just last month. But it's already published. It's available, and so we talked about this one a lot. But is there anything that we haven't said about it that you think is important that you'd want to know that you want to say to people about the report of the COVID Commission?
Well, if one agrees with the basic thesis of that, that there needs to be this independent inquiry, the more people that say that, the better, because the current political class in Ottawa think they can change the channel on this, that people will forget about all this and they're just tired of it and don't want to talk about it anymore. So if you agree with kind of the thesis of that, of that little book, expressing it that you want to see an independent, you know, tell your MLA, tell your councillor, tell your MP, tell your local media person, tell your neighbor, we got to have one of these inquiries, so that next time the pollsters go out and ask this question, they say they go back with a worried frown on their face to the Prime Minister. Say, there's an awful lot of people out there saying they want this independent inquiry. I think that would be one thing they could do. And if you want to be more specific, I think there should be much greater national protest about how Tamara is being persecuted. That this is a blot on the country. Where are the civil libertarian organizations that are protesting that? Where is the Métis Association of Alberta involved in any way? This is one of their people, the folks in Medicine Hat. I know Medicine Hat.
Yeah.
That's a great part. They're not afraid to do something different. This is one of your people, Medicine Hat. You guys are.
Yeah.
You know, I just think more people need to protest that treatment of her, because if that ever becomes the standard for treating someone that is involved in what I view as a legitimate democratic protest, then an awful lot of other people are in trouble besides Tamara. Yeah.
Heaven help us. So the next book is also one of yours. And I should tell you, when I had Danielle Smith on this program, she cited you as one of her major political influences. And when I asked her for a book, a suggestion, this is the book that she suggested. It's one that you wrote. It's called Do Something, 365 Ways You Can Strengthen Canada. And I just give the description here. It says, politicians, legislatures, and parliament are widely mistrusted. Canadians do not see their issues and concerns reflected in their priorities of the people elected to serve them. We've talked about that today. The rise of populism is one symptom of discontent. Others are low voter turnouts and an increasingly vicious public sphere. It's time for Canadians to repair and strengthen their democracy. It is time to do something! In this riveting and inspirational book, author and parliamentarian Preston Manning calls on Canadians of all beliefs and allegiances to renew their nation's democracy and ideas, processes, and institutions that support it. And so you give 365 practical ways people can get involved and make a difference in their communities and on the national stage. And there's a quote here. There's an old saying that a Canadian optimist is someone who believes things could be worse, but I'm an optimist who believes the future can be better if enough of us resolve to make it so. Fair enough. And I've read this book and it's wonderful. I highly recommend it. I agree with when Danielle Smith told me about it, I read that book. And then the third one I have is also one of yours. It's one I read a few years ago, Faith, Leadership, and Public Life. And this is Leadership Lessons from Moses to Jesus. This is one obviously that will speak, especially to Christians. And it certainly did so for me. But I think also people, even non-Christians, I think will get a lot out of this book, because you don't just talk about Christianity. You talk about the principles of leadership and the importance of faith to leadership and the proper way. And
for lawmakers, the great lessons from the Judeo-Christian scriptures is you have this record of a 400-year experiment to try to make things better by the rule of law alone. That's what Moses was. If you had the law and you enforced the law and people would keep the law, you would reconcile people to God and you'd reconcile them to each other. And then you have these latter-day Old Testament prophets saying that something more than that is needed. Something mm-hmm. more to reconcile people to God or to reconcile them to yourself, if that's all you're, this dimension, if that's all you're interested in. And then that's what the New Testament gets into, a different way of mediating conflict. And that for a legislator, our family's been involved in making laws in Alberta or the federal parliament for over 55 years, hundreds and hundreds of statutes. I read the statutes of Alberta when I was 17, all of them. From a lawmaker standpoint, because my father insisted on it. And if you're a legislator, you got to understand the power of law and all the benefits of it, but you better understand the limits to law. You can't fix everything with a law. And that needs to be understood today. And that book tried to, I mean, it's not original to me. That's a lesson out of that the Judeo-Christian scriptures. But I think that's extremely important today and relevant to legislators, not just to citizens.
Okay, so we've talked about three of your books. Those are my selections. Are there any that you would recommend to people who have been listening to this podcast and want to learn more about these topics or ones that you think are relevant to our discussion?
Well, I've got so many of them, it's hard to narrow.
Well, there's always the Bible. That's a good one. Yeah. You can always default.
I've got this new one coming out, if it gets published, called the Red Tape Letters.
Oh, yes. Oh, how about the Screw Tape Letters? That's a great one.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and there's another old book. This is more on the, it's on the political side as well as on the religious side. I can't remember the name of the author. It's called The Training of the Twelve. Oh. And this guy is just quite a scholarly thing. It's written in it's a 19th century book, so it's written in kind of archaic language. But he gets into this question, how did this carpenter from Nazareth round up this crew of pretty, not that they didn't all go to Harvard kind of thing, and somehow turn them into what they became and the founders of something that has lasted over 2,000 years and even today has 1.5 billion people at least know what he was talking about. And this book is a very detailed description of how did that happen. And when one talks about training people today, either for participating as people of faith in the political arena or just how to participate. I had a group of friends that went to Israel a while back, and most of them were all kind of political people I knew. So when I knew they were going over there, I gave them this envelope. I said, you're not to open this envelope until you've toured the Galilee region, because that was their habit. They go to these historical places and they tour around for a day and then have a dinner at night and discuss what they'd see. So they went around Galilee and they had this dinner at some hotel that night, and I opened this envelope. What I had in my envelope is, here's a political assignment for you. you got to go to all those towns around Galilee, and you got to find 12 people. You don't have long to do this. You guys are just picking like that, and you got to give them some kind of training, so that and we don't have a lot of money for this. We got a carpenter shop in Nazareth, but we don't have a lot of money for this. But you got to do this, and 2,000 years from now, there has to be 1.5 billion people who knew what. So some of these are hardened political operators. That would be pretty hard to do, you know. And to me, even, not even on a spiritual basis, my admiration for Jesus of Nazareth, anybody that could do that, at least you ought to listen to what he said and what he mm-hmm. taught. Mm-hmm. So that would be one book that would be, it's called The Training of the 12, that for people.
I'm going to read that one. Although in fairness, Preston, he did have the power to perform miracles.
that helped. Yes, that helped. That's right.
Well, this has been such a pleasure. You've exceeded all of my highest expectations. I think you're just a treasure. It's so wonderful to talk with you. Wow. I hope we get the chance to do it again. And I hope I get a chance to see you again and shake your hand and say hello. But thank you so much for being part of Gray Matter. I think the people taking this in are really going to enjoy it. And I think they're going to be able to engage in a very meaningful conversation with really, you know, well, I'll quote my friend Peter Hawley, the best prime minister we never had.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it too, Leighton. I hope it is beneficial to the people that watch.
Thank you.
Okay.